In this connection, mention may be made of one or two advantages occurring from subdivision and fragmentation of holdings. One advantage often mentioned is that because of the different pieces of land being under different climatic conditions, a farmer can make the best use of his labor and other resources. For example, if a certain piece of land does not get adequate rainfall, while the other does, he can shift himself to the other and thereby save his labor from being wasted. Another advantage concerns the income of the farmer. By keeping farms of different types under him, the farmer can compensate a bad crop in one farm by a good crop in the other, and thereby maintain some stability in his income. However, these arguments in favor of small and scattered holdings carry little weight. It is just not possible, much less profitable, to raise crops on such farms. It is unthinkable that farmers can make such gains as mentioned above. The overall impact of this evil is serious for agriculture. Main causes. In view of the fact that the effects of subdivision of farms into small units and their fragmentation are very harmful for the development of agriculture, it is necessary that a solution be found to tackle this problem. As a first step to the search for solutions, it is necessary that we identify the causes of this evil. The major causes are as below. Pressure of population. The pressure of rising population has been an important cause of this evil. India's population is not only large, it has been rising rapidly over the last many years. During this period, there has been no or very little increase in land under agriculture, nor has there been any worthwhile expansion of the non-agricultural sector. As a result, people had no alternative but to fall back on agriculture. The result is division and subdivision of existing holdings. The second cause is lack of employment. Had there been an increase in job opportunities in the non-agricultural sector, population growth would not have been that big a factor in causing this evil. But the expansion of employment has been very less. All the new entrants to the labor force could not be given employment when there was not enough work even for the existing unemployed laborers. As a result, the pressure on land increased. The third cause is decline of joint family. In the past, the joint family system kept the size of farms intact despite the rise in the number of family members from generation to generation. But now, this system is breaking up under the influence of modern education, Western thought, etc. As a result, each member of the family, when grown up, wants to set up his separate family and do his cultivation separately, resulting in subdivision and fragmentation of land. And the fourth cause is laws of inheritance. The laws of inheritance handed down from the British days are such that not only they do not prevent breakup of large farms, but positively facilitate subdivision and fragmentation of holdings. The laws not only recognize the share of each inheritor, but also allow the claim of each claimant in every piece. There is no restriction on the minimum size below which land is not allowed to be divided. Hence, subdivision and fragmentation can be carried to any extent. Farmers' indebtedness is the fifth cause. It has been seen that that quite often the farmer, under heavy debt, sells part of his land to pay off his debts. Again, it has been found that the moneylender traps the illiterate farmer into taking loans with the sole aim of getting hold of his land. This results in the division of land into small units. And the last cause is attachment to land. In India, the possession of land is considered a matter of prestige, social status and security. Therefore, people stick to it, however small may be the size of land. As a result, nobody leaves his share. Instead, everyone insists on taking his part in each plot, leading to splitting of land into small pieces. Important measures. We may now take up the measures necessary for the eradication of the evil of subdivision and fragmentation of holdings. Broadly, these measures can be listed under three categories: increasing the size of holdings, consolidation of holdings, and cooperative farming. Increasing the size of holdings. To make the size of holdings suitable for operational efficiency, it is of utmost importance that the size of existing small holdings be increased. Of course, what the extent is to which it should be raised depends upon several factors which differs from place to place. It may be that all the small farms cannot be increased in size in view of the overall scarcity of land in the country. In that case, the aim should be to raise the size of maximum number of farms. Towards this end, several measures can be suggested. Among them, the important ones are, under the policy of ceiling, the surplus land available should be used to increase the size of holdings of those whose farms are uneconomic in size. Along with it, it should be made obligatory for those whose holdings do not come up to the size of economic holdings to join cooperatives. This will ensure pooling of small pieces to make them operationally viable units. The second point is, some land may also be available through reclamation, which can be used for this purpose. These two suggestions, however, cannot by themselves solve the problem, because in neither case can enough land for the purpose becomes available. Third point would be, besides increasing the size, it is necessary that further subdivision and fragmentation of holdings be prevented. This requires modification of existing laws of inheritance in such a manner that holdings of minimum size are not allowed to be subdivided. An associated step is to put restrictions on such purchases and sales of land which result in reducing the size of holdings. In this sphere, the policy of population control or family planning will also help in preventing further breakup of holdings by reducing the demand for land. And the fourth point is, another solution lies in withdrawing farmers having tiny holdings from the work of cultivation to some non-agricultural work. This will necessitate the establishment of agro-industries and small-scale and cottage industries in villages to find work for such agriculturists. The land thus released can be joined with other tiny pieces to make them operationally viable. And the second measure would be consolidation of holdings. The main solution to the problem of fragmented holdings lies in consolidating them. Under it, the owner of several scattered pieces is given land at one place equivalent to all his pieces. This process of consolidation can be done in either of two ways. In one case, all the holdings of a village are pooled together into one block, and then each villager is given land as per his share. In the second case, holders of scattered units exchange their holdings so that each one is left with one holding in a compact block. The second method is a rather difficult process because it requires that each holder should have equivalent pieces to exchange and that he should be willing to do so. Further, the process of exchange is voluntary and as such, it may or may not be undertaken. As against this, the process of consolidation under the first case is done by the government. Moreover, in this scheme of things, there is no need for the existence of equivalent plots. Hence, it is more practicable. The work of consolidation in the country has long been in operation. However, all the states have not as yet passed laws in respect of consolidation of holdings. The work of consolidation has been completed fully in Punjab and Haryana. Much progress has also been recorded in UP, Bihar, Gujarat, Himachal Pradesh, Jammu and Kashmir, and Karnataka. The work of consolidation is under way in Madhya Pradesh and Orissa. So far, 51.8 million hectares of land has been consolidated. When all is said and done, the fact of the matter is that only in two states the work of consolidation has been fully completed. Therefore, in this sphere, there is need to do more. Some of the major lines on which progress can be hoped for may be briefly indicated. First, there is a need to pursue more vigorously the work of consolidation as part of the policy of land reforms. Again, in the work of consolidation, there is the need to keep it flexible. For example, the ownership title deed should be so framed that these farmers, when needed, can go over to the non-agricultural sector without being too much affected or bound by legal documents. Further, As suggested by the Ford Foundation study group, consolidation should be so designed that leadership in the field is promoted. In other words, such farmers should be encouraged to be benefited as would prove to be lead farmers. It may also be added that preparation of land records be taken up along with the work of consolidation so as to consolidate the progress made and to promote further reforms. And the third measure is cooperative farming. Sealing on land, reclamation of land and consolidation of holding will definitely help in the solution of the many problems of small farms. But because of the non-availability of adequate land, it may not be possible to increase the size of all the small farms. It is here that cooperative farming becomes relevant. Very small farmers with land below the desirable limit can pool their lands and operate more efficiently. These farmers will continue to be owners of their land and will share the surplus produce as per their contribution of the land. Of course, these cooperatives have to be of a special type. Under it, labor is to be engaged to the extent that total production is maximized. This means that the employment of labor should be determined by the consideration of additions to production and not the market wage. It is only then that the participating farmer will have more employment and the country more production. Such cooperatives should get help from the non-farming cooperatives in matters of credit, marketing, etc., facilitating the smooth working of the cooperative farming. Now, the serious difficulties with these measures are, however, the task of increasing the size of small holding is not an easy one and it comes up against certain hurdles. Broadly, these are of two types. One, the Indian farmer through centuries has been so wedded to land that its possession is a part of his very existence. Culturally, socially and economically, he feels the necessity of keeping the myth of paper ownership, however small may be the size of land. Secondly, the farmer finds himself surrounded by an atmosphere where he sees that it is the power of private property that rules supreme. With no alternatives open to him, the land is the only cover under which he takes shelter. He is therefore not inclined to part with his land, however small it may be, for the sake of any organization like a cooperative or for some doubtful job of a laborer in a non-agricultural occupation, even if one is available in the village. These difficulties are mentioned to highlight the fact that the problem of subdivision and fragmentation is not merely an administrative one. It is also to be viewed as a problem of the Indian polity. With this, we have come to the end of Chapter 19, Land Reforms. Chapter number 35, New Industrial Policy, page number from 460 to 472. The New Industrial Policy, NIP, is in operation since 1991, including some amendments since then, marks a big departure from the old policy. The changes in the industrial scene it involves will reshape the entire economic life in a profound way. We discuss the various features of this policy and work out their implications for the industrial development of the country. This will be followed by an assessment of the policy in terms of its likely contributions to the solutions of the many serious problems India faces. Features and implications of New Industrial Policy 1991. The new policy was announced in two stages, rather in two parts. The first part, announced on 24 July 1991, concerned the large industries, including the medium-sized industries. The second part, announced on 6th August 1991, dealt with small industries. We shall take them separately, as also together whenever necessary for the sake of analysis. Prior to this policy, several policy statements governed the functioning of industries. The major policy formulation which held the ground all these years since the mid-50s was, however, the one announced in 1956. Before that, the policy statement, the first after independence, was made in 1948. Subsequent announcements were by and large in the nature of minor changes in one or the other part or parts of the 1956 policy, largely to meet the problems faced in the years when these changes were made. These policy statements were made in 1973, 77, 80, 85 and 86. Together, these did amount to some significant modification of the 1956 policy. But in its essentials, the 1956 policy remained intact all these years. In dealing with the subject, we shall first take up the large industries. The description of the policy relating to the small sector will be taken up under a separate head. Objectives and measures. To begin with, we describe the objectives which the new industrial policy has set before itself. We also enumerate the measures by which the policy is to achieve its aims. A description of these will give us an idea of the shape of things to come. Progressive economy. The overall aim of the policy is to achieve a sort of development which makes industries dynamic in their growth and which renders justice to the people. To quote the policy statement, it involves a struggle for social and economic justice, to end poverty and unemployment, and to build a modern, democratic, socialist and forward-looking India. It also implies building a society wherein India grows as part of the world economy and not in isolation. Reduced in terms of concrete economic tasks and programs, the policy aims at such important areas as the following: utilizing fully the indigenous capabilities of entrepreneurs, fostering R&D, that is research and development, efforts for the development of indigenous technologies, raising investments, improvements in efficiency and productivity, controlling monopolistic behavior, assigning the right areas for the public sector undertakings, and ensuring welfare as also skills and facilitates to the workers to enable them to deal with inevitability of technological change. As for the external sector is concerned, while the policy continues to pursue the goal of self-reliance, it places greater emphasis on building up of our ability to pay for our imports through our own foreign exchange earnings. Greater market orientation. In achieving the various aims, the policy envisages the use of market in a big way. It intends to dismantle the restrictive and regulatory system and thereby unshackle the industrial economy from the cobwebs of unnecessary bureaucratic control. This is to allow the private entrepreneurs to make their commercial decisions on their own with no government judgment to bind them. In other words, the allocation of resources among industries in respect of type of industries, size of their scale and the nature of products will be determined by the market prices. This freedom will also foster competition among the entrepreneurs. The market incentives will also be used to influence the industrial development. It is also intended to develop capital markets so as to provide avenues of financial resources for the entrepreneurs. This involves the emergence of a variety of financial instruments like loans, shares, debentures, etc. The policy also lays stress on and provides an easy entry to the foreign direct investments, that is equity capital and technology. Even foreign private trading houses have been assigned an important role in the expansion of India's exports. The public sector too finds a place as an important instrument of industrial development. Its role will however be restricted to some well-defined areas which are essential for the industrial economy. This will mean shedding off of some unwanted fat of these undertakings. The upshot of the whole set of means is that the market and the private entrepreneur and not the bureaucrat will govern the industrial development, with public sector undertakings, that is PSUs, providing the support, albeit indirectly. Strengthening private sector. A major step towards a greater marketization of the industrial economy is the abolition of the licensing system for a large number and a large variety of industries. Two major features of the new industrial policy involve a big change in the industrial setup of the country towards a greater role for the private sector. Larger scope. Besides the existing industries in the private sector, some provisions in the policy amount to an enlargement of the field of operation for the private sector. The contraction in fields for the operation of the public sector, for example, leaves open more space for the private sector to operate. A number of activities which have so far been exclusively in the realm of public sector have now been thrown open to the private sector. The public sector has now been left with only 6 reserved industries, with the remaining having been thrown open to the private sector. These include aircraft manufacture, air transport, shipbuilding, processing of non-ferrous metals, iron and steel, generation and distribution of electricity, telephones and telephone cables, telegraph and wireless apparatus, heavy casting and forging of iron and steel, heavy plant and machinery required for iron and steel production, for mining and heavy electric plant, including large hydraulic and steam turbines. Besides these old industries, there will be new industries that will come up in the private sector. In addition to this, the expansion in the private sector will take place on account of the increase in the number of industries wherein foreign equity or foreign direct investment is now allowed. These industries include hotels and tourism industry and all food processing industries. Dismantling of controls. The private sector has further been strengthened as it has almost been freed from the government restrictions in respect of its functioning. The industrial licensing or government approval required for the creation of industrial capacities or investment has been abolished for all projects except for 15 specified groups. These areas pertain to industries related to security and strategic concerns, social reasons, hazardous chemicals and overriding environmental reasons, and items of elitist consumption, etc. The exemption from licensing also applies to all substantial expansion of existing units. There is again no restriction on broadbanding or producing any product as long as additional investment in plant and machinery is not involved. As a consequence, the industries are not required to register themselves with the government. They are only required to file an information memorandum on new projects and substantial expansion. Another area which provides freedom to the private sector is in respect of foreign technology. Its entry into high priority industries will receive automatic approval. Similar facilities are also available for other industries as well, if agreements pertaining to the transfer of foreign technology do not require the expenditure of free foreign exchange. The entry of foreign investors in the country with equity share up to 51% and recently even up to 100% in some cases is allowed with no limitation. All this amounts to the use of market-related prices and incentives, rather than government administrative fiat for making commercial decisions. The private sector has thus been expanded and the activities marketized. Dispersing industries. Another feature of the NIP, that is National Industrial Policy, which is significant for the economy, bears upon the location of new industries. The provisions in respect of this aspect are to ensure decentralization of the industrial activities geographically towards rural and backward areas. The thrust of the policy is to shift industries away from big congested cities to the rural and backward areas. For example, in respect of locations other than cities of more than 1 million population, the industrialist will not be required to obtain industrial approval from the central government except for industries subject to compulsory licensing. However, in regard to such cities, that is with population greater than 1 million, which require industrial regeneration, a flexible location policy would be adopted. In the big cities, that is with population greater than 1 million, industries other than those of non-polluting nature, such as electronics, computer, software and printing, will be allowed outside 25 kilometers of the periphery except in prior designated industrial areas. Thus, in respect of such locations, the aim is to reduce congestion in the areas already much congested. Various measures. To implement the location policy, both legal measures and incentives will be used. For example, industrial location will, as at present, continue to be governed by laws concerning zoning, land use and environmental needs. Incentives in the form of cheap land credit, etc., are also thought of as instruments to attract industries away from congested areas to uncongested areas like villages and backward regions and also suburbs. It is also intended to so design investments in infrastructure development that the areas which are lagging in industries are helped. Besides thus benefiting these areas, the new industrial policy also favors the expansion of agro-based industries near the farming areas. In the sphere of small industries and rural industries, a number of provisions have been made to ensure their development in small towns and villages. Redefining the role of public sector. In view of the many problems the public sector undertakings, PSUs, suffer from, such as very low rate of return on the capital invested, insufficient growth in productivity, poor management, etc., the new industrial policy seeks to re-examine their placing in the economy. A broad frame has also been indicated within which the PSUs are to function. Unsuitable areas. The policy pinpoints the areas which, being not fit for the PSUs, are to be vacated by them. One is a set of 6 industrial units which the public sector took over and which accounts for almost 1/3 of the total losses of central public enterprises. There is another group of public enterprises, quite large, many in numbers, which are engaged in producing consumer goods and services. These do not fit into the original perception of PSUs as being those which are to be at the commanding heights of the economy. Besides, the policy promises to make a review of the existing portfolio of public investments with greater realism. It is mentioned that this review will be in respect of industries based on low technology, small scale and non-strategic areas, inefficient and unproductive areas, areas with low or nil social considerations or public purpose, and areas where the private sector has developed sufficient expertise and resources. Obviously, in this assessment, the intention is to reduce the role of public sector in these areas. Suitable areas. The new approach that marks the new industrial policy is to specify the role and the areas of operation that fit in with the undertakings that are public in character. It is, for example, stated that there must be a greater commitment to the support of public enterprises which are essential for the operation of the industrial economy. In this frame, the priority areas for growth of public sector in the future are laid out. These areas cover the following: essential infrastructure goods and services, exploration and exploitation of oil and mineral resources, technology development and building of manufacturing capabilities in areas which are crucial in the long-term development of the economy, and where private sector investment is inadequate, manufacture of products where strategic considerations predominate, such as defense equipment. In this light, the policy has listed 6 industries which are to be reserved for the public sector. These are defense products, atomic energy, coal and lignite, mineral oils, railway transport, and minerals relating to the atomic energy. While these are the reserved areas, it is also stated in the policy that the public sector will not be barred from entering areas not specially reserved for it. Improving their working. The industrial policy also lays great stress on the upgradation of the conduct of the PSUs through various means. It is stated that measures must be taken to make these enterprises more growth-oriented and technically dynamic. Units which may be faltering at present but are potentially viable must be restructured and given a new lease of life. It is also emphasized that the government will strengthen those public enterprises which fall in the reserved areas of operation or are in high priority areas or are generating good or reasonable profits.
It is provided that such enterprises will get a much greater degree of management autonomy through the system of memorandum of understanding, specifying the rights and obligations of the enterprises and the government. It is also envisaged that competition will be inducted in these areas by permitting private sector also to participate in these activities. In the case of selected enterprises, part of government holdings in the equity will be disinvested in order to provide further market discipline to the performance of public enterprises. The new policy extends the jurisdiction of MRTP Act, that is Monopoly Restrictive Trade Practices Act, to the public enterprises. This will be a legal safeguard against the working of PSUs to the detriment of public interest in respect of monopolistic, restrictive and unfair trade practices. Important role for foreign investments. The new policy expects significant contributions from foreign entrepreneurs in the fields of investments, trade and technology. For this, liberal provisions have been made for their easy entry into the industrial scene of the country. Direct investments. The entry of foreign investors in the form of direct or equity investment is being encouraged by allowing control of majority share in several areas, as against 40% before. This majority ownership will enable for foreigners to control the working of the enterprises in which they invest. The areas in which these investments are to be invited are high priority industries requiring large resources and advanced technology. The agreements between foreigners and Indians in respect of these projects will get automatic approval from the government. The entry of foreign investors in these industries up till now has been given, but only on a case-by-case basis, that is, on a discretionary basis. Now, the entry will face no bottlenecks. This will make the Indian policy on foreign investment transparent, and it is hoped that such a framework will make it attractive for companies to invest in India. Trading companies. Apart from foreign direct investments, the new policy also seeks help from foreign trading companies in the field of exports from India. It is stressed in the policy that the promotion of exports of Indian products calls for a systematic exploration of world markets, which is possible only through intensive and highly professional marketing activities. The policy further states that, to the extent the expertise of this nature is not well developed so far in India, the government will encourage foreign trading companies to assist us in our export activities. To get an access to the world markets, as also to attract foreign investments and advanced technology, the government is to appoint a special board to negotiate with the world's largest industrial manufacturing and marketing firms. Foreign technology. The entry of foreign technology too has been made easy in the new industrial policy. There is provision that allows automatic approval for technology agreements related to high priority industries. Similar facilities will also be available for other industries if such agreements do not require the expenditure of free foreign exchange. Further, it is also provided that no prior clearance would be required for the hiring of foreign technicians and foreign testing of indigenously developed technologies. With no interference by the government, it is hoped that Indian business will develop relationship with the suppliers of foreign technology as also foreign investors on a continuing basis and make their decisions on the basis of commercial considerations. It is further hoped that the Indian businesses will make necessary efforts to absorb foreign technologies by devoting larger funds to research and development. High priority industries. The industries in which the approvals of foreign investments and foreign technology have been made automatic are important ones for the Indian economy. A brief description of the same should give an idea of the change that the new policy has ushered in this respect. These industries are metallurgical industries, boilers and steam generating plants, electrical equipment, telecommunication equipments, transportation, industrial machinery, industrial instruments, and chemicals, and others. These industries are largely in the nature of those producing capital goods, as also those basic materials which are relevant for strengthening the productive capacity of the economy, as also in injecting new and most modern products. These require large investments and the most advanced technologies. Controlling monopolies. The restrictions on the functioning of monopolies embodied in the Monopolistic and Restrictive Trade Practices Act, that is MRTP Act, in operation since June 1970, have also been removed. Instead, emphasis now is on tackling the undesirable monopolistic activities. Removal of asset limit. In terms of the position till recently, the companies with assets of rupees 100 crores or more were required to seek government's prior approval in respect of a number of their activities. These activities pertain to the expansion of existing firms, the establishment of new undertakings, mergers, amalgamations, and takeovers. They had even to seek permission from the government for appointment of certain directors of these companies. Restrictions also existed in respect of the acquisition of and transfer of shares of these companies. The new industrial policy does away with the concept of asset limit itself. This eliminates the requirements of prior approval of the central government in respect of the activities concerning expansion, new undertakings, etc. This change only removes procedural delays, because in the past MRTP companies were rarely refused to set up new project or expand the existing ones, etc. The change thus conforms to the reality, but in doing so, the companies have been saved from the time-consuming procedures involving heavy cost in seeking and getting approvals for their proposals. Curbs on anti-social activities. The emphasis has now shifted to taking appropriate action against monopolistic, restrictive, and unfair trade practices on the part of monopolies. These dominant undertakings or monopolies have now been identified as those who control over 25% share of the market. In fact, from this angle, the new industrial policy has widened and strengthened the provisions of the MRTP Act and their implementation through the Monopoly Commission. For example, the public sector undertakings hitherto outside the purview of this Act have been brought within the orbit of this law. The shares too have been included within the definition of goods. Further, the chit funds and dealings in real estate have also been brought within the definition of services. This way, the malpractices in these fields will get another avenue of redressal besides regular courts. The new policy also provides for the strengthening of the MRTP Commission so that it can undertake more effectively the investigation of malpractices on its own, or on complaints received from industrial consumers or other classes of consumers. Promoting small sector industries. The new industries policy for the small sector industries, announced on 6th August 1991, envisages a number of changes in the old policy with a view to making them strong and viable units. Financial support. The most important feature of this policy is the 4-point scheme to provide financial support to the small-scale industries, that is SSI sector. One is to ensure the supply of adequate flow of credit to these industries to meet their entire needs on a normative basis, that is, in terms of what ought to be their needs. It marks a departure from the old policy of concentrating on providing cheap credit. Besides providing credit needs of industrial units, this provision also includes identification of select industries in large clusters which would be provided financial support by Small Industries Development Bank of India, that is SIDBI. The National Equity Fund scheme, as also the single window scheme, have been enlarged to provide larger funds to projects involving larger capital outlays. 2. The new policy allows equity participation by other or non-SSI industrial undertakings in the SSI sector up to 24% of the total shareholding. This is being done to provide small units access to the capital market and to encourage modernization, technical upgradation, ancillarization, that is producing from the non-SSI firms, and subcontracting, that is taking on the work in parts on contract basis from the main contractor. 3. A limited partnership is to be allowed, which would limit the financial liability of the new and non-active partners or entrepreneurs to the extent of capital invested. This would enhance the supply of risk capital to the SSI sector. 4. Provisions have been made to ensure speedy payments arising from the sale of products of the SSI sector. One such provision, called factoring service, involves payment to the SSI by SIDBI, that is SIDBI or Small Industrial Development Bank of India, and or by agencies to be operated by commercial banks before these are collected from the buyers by these agencies. This will, to a great extent, solve the problems of the delayed payments to the small sector by the large units. Another measure consists of suitable legislation to ensure prompt payment of small industries bill. Supply of raw materials and marketing. The new policy also provides for the supply of raw materials and marketing facilities to the SSI units. As for the indigenous raw materials are concerned, the SSI units would be accorded priority by the government while allocating these materials. It is also to be ensured that the small sector gets adequate and fair share of the raw materials available, both indigenous and imported. However, it will be seen that in so doing, the entry of new units in the small sector is not adversely affected. As for marketing, the policy envisages market promotion of their products to be undertaken by cooperatives, public sector institutions, and other professional agencies. It is also expected that these agencies would undertake a consortium approach, that is, they work together in providing facilities for their sale. It is also provided in the policy that the National Small Industries Corporation, that is NSIC, would concentrate on marketing of mass consumption items under a common brand name in association with the State Small Industries Development Corporation, that is SSIDCs. In the sphere of marketing, provision has also been made for the export of products of the small sector. The nodal agency for export promotion will be the Small Industry Development Organization, that is SIDO. It will make efforts to augment export activities, including the improvements in productivity and competitiveness of the SSI products. Production and quality. Several measures have been incorporated in the policy to ensure larger production and better quality of the products. One such measure aims at widening and deepening the complementarity in the production programs of large, medium and small sectors. This will be ensured through the production of parts, components, sub-assemblies, etc. by the small ancillary units which are required by the large public and private industries. The production will thus become viable technically and economically. It is also emphasized that these industries will be located in the rural and backward areas to ensure stronger coordination between industry and agriculture. This will facilitate the easy access to raw materials, particularly in respect of agro industries. A program for modernization and technology upgradation is also envisaged for these industries to raise production and productivity. Special emphasis is also laid on the improvements of the quality of these products. The policy promises to encourage and support industrial associations to establish quality counseling and common testing facilities.